Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of Our History here at the Carlton Football Club at Visage Park. Today's guest. His was an all-too-brief career, 65 games in three seasons from 1981 through 1983. But for those who saw him play, his was truly a highlights reel, littered with high marks, spectacular goals, and the triumphs of back-to-back grand final victories, which set the David Park and Coach Carlton teams apart through those glory years of 1981 and 1982. Wearing the number 4 Guernsey, he later tried to get back from Stephen Kernaghan. This man got the turnstiles ticking over at Princes Park and everywhere else for that matter, because he played the game with an audacity and flair less seen now, where team and structure are the more familiar buzzwords. But 30 years ago, he was the buzzword, or more precisely, the buzz. He is, of course, Peter Bozzasso. He's in town from his native Perth in Western Australia, and he's here today in the studio at Visage Park. Peter, welcome back to Carlton.
G'day, Tony, and, you know, I don't know about the home back there, mate. This is my second home. I just love coming back to the club, and thanks very much for the red carpet and the dancing girls. A couple of bluebirds, ex-bluebirds out there too, Tony. How did you organise that?
We spare no expense here, Peter, as you know. And it, might I say, Peter, sitting here in the ironically named Brewstool Media Room, it's great to see that famous mark of yours against Geelong in 81, yes, gracing the wall.
Well, you see the little white mark at the top of my head there, Tone? That's the grandstand roof. I nearly hit my head on it, you know? And, of course, the aircraft at the Tullamarine rang the press box, if you wouldn't believe, and David Parkin said, you know, keep Buzz out of our airspace, will you?
We will get to that mark very soon, Peter. Yep. But we, of course, have a lot to cover. And, first of all, I want to ask you, the fact you're in Melbourne town, what brings you back? What are you doing?
Look, a lot of PR stuff, Tony, and a lot of charity work, a lot of fundraising for clubs, and we do a lot of that. And with, you know, Mark Jacko Jackson and Warwick Kappa, Alex Jezalinko. Jezza comes with us a few times, and out of our little spot over in Lygon Street, a very good base camp we got there at Bar Central in Lygon Street. Our mine host Carl Sabatini, an absolute rampant Carlton supporter, and he looks after me all the time. But no, it's great to get back to Melbourne, Tone. I try and get back 2 or 3 times a year because I love it here. You know, Carlton did absolutely the right thing by me all those years ago, and you know, if I can do anything for the club whatsoever, you know, I'm usually in for the bum fight, mate. So, you know, so, but it's great to be here. Yeah,
Peter, we've got a lot to pour through, and we begin really by talking about your father, Bob Bozzasso, who of course was a Carlton player.
Yes.
Here, a 20 game player in two seasons through 55 and 56, and the club's best first year player in 55. Are you able to talk a little bit about Dad's football career, specifically his time at Carlton? I know he's no longer with us, but did he ever shed light on those early days here?
Oh, he loved it, Tone, and you know, and you would, I don't think you actually mentioned this, but he was number 4 as well. Now, that isn't amazing. I didn't know that at all till you know, the historians at the club actually spoke to me a couple of years ago, and I didn't actually know that, you know. So, and when you said that about Stephen a couple of years later when I come back, I don't know what they would have done, Steve. I had to come back, and I don't know what they would have done, Tony. Number 4 was very, very to my heart, and you know, over the years I've been watching it with an eagle eye, the number 4 who's got the jumper, and they don't have to answer to Steve Cooney, and they've got to answer to me, the number 4. So, but no, mate, look, Dad was a halfback flanker, a bit stocky, 5'10", you know, played off that halfback line in the pocket and that sort of thing, but very, very tough player. He used to tell me that. But look, I was the flairy type, you know, and I kicked the unwarranted things, you know, spectacular marks, goals and that sort of thing. So a bit different than Dad, but no, I don't really know too much about it. But, you know, his name is in the history of Carlton Football Club, which I'm proud of, yeah.
Did he have an auspicious career in the Waffle? Was he a good player back home, local football?
Yes, he was. He played with Perth, the same club as I did. I went through the same thing. And, of course, as you just mentioned, the father-son rule come into effect. And that's another story time. Would you like me to go into that story regarding the arrival at Princes Park?
Absolutely. You threw a different slant on it, Peter. I understand that there were overtures from another club before that.
Oh, look, there was plenty of overtures. When I kicked 7 goals in the 78 grand final in the wet in Perth, you know, the Geelongs, the Richmonds, you know, the even Collingwood. But I actually signed about 3 or 4 weeks later with North Melbourne under a Form 4. Now, Tane, a Form 4 in those days, if you come to Melbourne within the 2 years, you had to play for that club. You know, Barassi, and that was with North Melbourne. Now, Tone, I thought I was a bit slim and a bit, you know, I had to put on weight. I'd played a couple of state games, and that really, you know, bore me aware that, you know, I've got to, you know, I've got to put on some, you know, some condition. And Dad was a very big influence on me in that time, and he actually said to me, you know, you're just not ready, you're just not ready yet. Of course, now, Tone, you're 17, 18, you've got to be ready, you know, thus the GWS, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I decided to stay a few more years, get a couple of state games under my belt, you know, play with some great players. Robert Wiley, of course, ended up going to Richmond, and Alan Johnson went to Melbourne, and I decided to stay those other 2 years. Now, mid-'80, 1980, Carlton come a courting, and you know, they brought their chequebook with them, and you know, I liked a lot of zeros on the end of my stuff, Tone. You know, so so I actually didn't know they were here this particular game, and I kicked 11 against South Fremantle in the Waffle, and they had great players like Maurice Rioli playing for them, and Benny Vigona, a state player, Stephen Michael, probably the greatest ruckman never to come to Victoria, and Jimmy Ellison, and of course the hierarchy, invited me to come to Melbourne, but not beknownst to me, they were playing in Sydney in their promotional games, you know, in 80. So I flew to Sydney with the actual team. Percy Jones was the coach, and I sat in the Sydney cricket grandstand, the Don Bradman stand, whatever it was, Tony, and got wooed by Carlton, and I actually signed the form. I asked the question, of course, hang on, you can't sign me. I can't sign with two clubs. I'll accept the cash, but, you know, I can't sign with two clubs. But and, of course, that the rest is history. I signed. I was that excited, you know, that I was going to wear the navy blue jumper. It wasn't a fluke that I sort of chose Carlton. You know, I had two players that I really wanted to play football with. One was Wayne Johnston, and one was Mark McClure. Now, that happened to be across the half-forward line, I know, but, you know, I just watched the 79 grand final. I thought, geez, it'd be great to play for that club.
So you were watching on from afar, and those were the players that really piqued your interest. You wanted to play in that team with those guys.
Yep, and, of course, you can throw in Southby and Dool and Roddy Ashman and these sort of guys, and we won 79. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Tane, we were two games clear in 80, and we got beaten in straight sets. So actually, Carlton actually said to me, we need to shore up a half forward and a half back. Now, a great player, Ken Hunter, come with me. Now, that's another story, Tone. We had our last game in Perth in 1980. Kenny and I were playing, and 4,000 people were there going, good on you, Kenny. Good on you, Buzzer. Good luck for next year. Good luck at Carlton. Da-da-da-da-da, you know. So we go the first game, and we come over together in 1980.
So through that period, were you and Ken Hunter confiding, you know, about the move? Mm. You know, it was good in retrospect that you had each other to share this experience.
Sure,
Was that important?
Oh, very, very important. Tony, it goes back a little bit further. Kenny and I actually played together in junior academy squads, and Kenny's mum and dad moved to Claremont area out of it, and then we started to play against each other. But I was well aware how good Hunter was. Well aware, you know, and we often played against each other maybe we broke even. Maybe Kenny might have been in front, because Hunter was just an unbelievable player at Waffle level, because he just dominated, you know, the competition there. And I was just so grateful that, you know, to come across with him. And Tony, I think Carlton people have got to be very, very aware that, you know, and I'm not, you know, blowing my own trumpet, but, you know, we went to a side that was ready for a halfback. Now, you know, I'd be shuddering if I played for North Melbourne at Dool, Perovic and Hunter. I would have been shaken, Tony. You know, that's why I went to Carlton, you know. But you know what I mean. It was just such a fantastic, you know, period to be with the club, because they'd already had the mounting, didn't they, of premierships. And, you know, to get David Parkin, you know, over at that stage was just a huge coup for the club.
I was going to mention David Parkin. It was a pivotal year. That was his first year at the club. And that was also a year where I think Kevin Sheedy signed at Essendon,
that's
Alan
correct,
Jones at Hawthorn, and Barassi at Melbourne. Mm. So it was an amazing year in that respect. Mm. David Parkin, you know, as a coach, how did you find him?
Oh, changed my career. No doubt. Changed my career. Yeah, Tony, I kicked 75, 80 and 85 the previous 3 years, you know, and Parkin come across and just you know, he actually come across once just to talk to me. he said, I want you there in October, November. I said, David, I don't start pre-season until the end of February. And I don't think he took too well to that, though. But but I had a sports shop at the time, or a couple of sports shops, and I just said, look, can you give me a rundown and I'll adhere to that. you know, come across about mid-February, and I was pretty fit in those days, and had a regime that the Carlton phys eds give me, and I slotted pretty well straight into it. I was a great believer in, say, having half fitness, three-quarter fitness by the time the scratch matches, and maybe full fitness by the time the scratch matches come available. But Parkin had his few, you know, little idiosyncrasies that we had to do. But no, look, he allowed me to do a lot of things. First game, Tony, you know, unbelievable. You know, I shot my mouth off for about 2 or 3 weeks. How high I could jump, you know, how good I could tackle, how good I can, run around and kick goals, etc., etc. Run out onto the ground, Tony. We'd just come from 4,000 people saying, "Get on your bus." There's 77,000 people at the first game, Richmond versus Carlton, one of the biggest games, you know, of the year.
MCG.
Apart from, was that Waverley actually, Tony? Yeah, 77,000. And I'd run around like 20 minutes for the headless chook. I thought, I'm gone here, I'm gone. I've shot my mouth off. All of a sudden, I've seen the runner come screaming out to me, and I can't say the actual words that he said. It was something like, "You big-headed so-and-so from WA, you've shot your mouth off. What's going on?" I said, "I can't breathe. I can't move." Parkin actually saw this, Tony, and this is what I'm getting around to. That he sent the runner back, telling him to sit down, take a couple of breaths, stand up, just do a 360 around the ground, Tony, and take all the actual crowd in. And you know what? That helped me tremendously, because I had 30 possessions the next 3.5 quarters. I've kicked 3 goals, and I've become the player of the round in that first round when they used to do a player of the round. So David Parkin, as you just mentioned, what a fantastic coach. And he did blend a lot of 18 or 20 or 25 individuals into a champion team.
And I'd imagine, Peter, that, and I've always thought of you as a big occasion player, Brent Croswell, probably the same. You know, the bigger the crowd, the better you perform. Did you, as time went on, did you seem to use that as a spur, you know, to get you up for games? Yeah,
look, I did, and any other side, Tony, I don't think I would have been able to do it, because, you know, we blended very well together. You know, a lot of people say, that I was the flamboyant, but you know, Johnson could turn it on just like that too. I saw Wayne Johnson, the Dominator, you know, just crush sides, and I think that was the good part about the Carlton sides, because we had our real rock solid players, but we had a couple of flamboyant players, and we had a good working team. You know, the Mosquito Flute was outstanding, Tony. Marcoux, Ashburn, Buckley, Sheldon, Johnston, you know, Mayland, Glascott on the wings, and it was just a sensational side. And I think it's very close. I think it's very close to the best Carlton side ever in those 4 or 5 year period. I think we blended well together. And I think I mentioned to you before, Tom, we had the 82 reunion a couple of months ago at the MCG. 18 of the 20 there. Val Perovic, unfortunately, was sick on the day, and David Glascott was touring. Brucey Dool was even there at time. But that's the respect that we had for each other, and that's why I think we won, you know, 3 or 4 of the, you know, premierships in that time.
And David Parkin, you mentioned off air, was smart enough to afford the players a little bit of rope.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
obviously there were extroverts, standards were different than as they are today. Mm. And yet when you hit the track, it was head down, tail up.
Full on, yeah. No, that's a very good point. And Parkin actually made that a couple of times. But look, Tony, we're talking about in the old days. There was, you know, cans of VB, slabs of VD after the game, and cigarettes were done and all that sort of thing. And Parkin put up with that. He didn't like it, but he put up with that. And, you know, the boys in the end started to, you know, to call back from that, Tony, you know. And, you know, there was only one slab in the thing of the, a couple of weeks later, and one smoke. Now they've got snakes this long, glucose, and they've got water and Gatorade and, you know, they've got girls running around rubbing them and that sort of thing. But look, that's the evolution of football, isn't it? And,
were you actually a smoker or a drinker?
No,
you weren't at all.
No,
it wasn't an issue for you.
No, it didn't smoke. You know, there was only 3 or 4: Phil Mayne, I think, Kenny Hunter, Mark McClure. Jimmy would have the betting sheet in his pocket, you know. So he's checking the scoreboard. I was wondering what he's doing every now and then, mate. He's looking at the scoreboard. Looking at the score, Jimmy. No, the numbers in race 6, you know.
Now, I wanted to ask you, Peter, about settling in at Carlton, because you were taken in by the famous Leo Brooks at his house in Rathdown Street.
Yes.
You perhaps should explain for those who aren't initiated who Leo Brooks was and his connections.
Yeah, a fantastic stalwart of the club. When I first come over, Tony, in late, as I said, late February, I didn't have anywhere to stay, and they actually said, look, Leo was our sort of confidant or whatever, and he'd cook a meal for us or whatever. And I moved into a little one-bedroom apartment, you know, while I was here, you know, till the pre-season. And then Look, that's another story. Please ask me about that in a minute, because that was a that was a big story, the actual signing in the first game. But Leo was a fantastic stalwart, as I just mentioned, and he just looked after me. And look, it's a absolute honour roll, isn't it? Brent Croswell stayed. Mike Fitzpatrick stayed with Leo. Wayne the Dominator Johnson stayed. Mike Fitzpatrick, you know, just went on and on myself, you know. So, and Leo had a bit of a link, a little bit of a link to a family called the Morans. Mark and Jason were absolute one-eyed Carlton supporters, you know.
But Leo's only, grandsons.
Yes, Leo's grandsons. And, of course, Judy, his daughter, she was involved with yes, it's quite hard to talk about it within an hour or so, Tone. But, no, look, and none of that was ever, you know, ever brought out. They were quite happy to be Carlton supporters, and they were in the rooms all the time. They were only 16 and 18 at the time, Tone, 20 by the time, you know, I left in 84. And, of course, a lot of the skullduggery happened around about the mid-90s and into the 90s, mate, yeah.
But still, you were looked after, you were well-treated, you felt at home.
Yes,
the house is still there, I take it. What number in Rathdown Street, Peter?
Well, he lived in Drummond Street, 777, I think, Drummond Street, and then went down to Canning Road, actually, Ken Hunter abides. But, look, Leo used to, you know, be the absolute doyen of the door there, and whatever, you know, the crackers were going off, and, you know, Penny Mangers, and, you know, he'd stir the place up and that sort of thing. And but it was, you know, it was just a delight. And Tony, look, you know, as I mentioned before, I signed with Carlton, and it wasn't a fluke, because I really wanted to wear that blue jumper with that navy, with that white insignia, you know, because it's one of the most powerful symbols, I thought, at the time in Australian football. And Tony, 6 or 7 games into the season, I'm going, I can't believe this. I'm playing for the greatest, you know, club. They're paying me to do it, and, you know, we're playing some unbelievable footy. So for a young fella from Western Australia, it was such a, you know, overbearing type thing. But, you know, people like Wes Lofts and David Parkin and, you know, these sort of guys, Brian Quirk, you know, kept the side, you know, really, really well together. And, you know, I think that's why we played very well, Tony, because we were, you know, switched on every... We didn't have to be threatened. We didn't have to be challenged to be motivated. I think it was just that a good a side. Tony, you might have the stats that year. Was it 19-3 or 22 that we won or something? In that year.
You're clearly the best side going around at that particular period.
In 81, I mean. In 82 was very, very similar. You know, I think it might have been about 16-5. But, you know, we had to work a little bit harder for the 82 one, but I'm sure we'll get to that later.
We'll get to it. I think I've got this right, Peter. In the second round against Hawthorne at Princes Park, you were running one way, Dipper might have been running the other.
Well,
and he came off actually second
best. Yes, well, look, you know, I had the first game, of course, I just explained. But the second game was against Cawthorn out here at our famous hallowed ground. And I really wanted to play here, you know, because Princes Park, you know, auditorium, 45,000 people. And I loved, Tony, I loved the sound, the roar, you know, when you ran on, loved the roar. And... I'd played pretty well the first 10 minutes. I kicked a couple and, you know, I used to go back and help the half-back line out just in case Dooley was under pressure. So this day, that was a 10-minute mark, and I swooped on a ball across half-back, you know, got a hand pass from Bruce, seared a 55-metre low drop punt to the skipper at centre-half forward. And I used to run the 10 seconds in, the 100 in 10 seconds in those days, Tony, but not that now. And I was on him in a flash, you know, when he was going to handball it to me, he thought not. I would have slopped it from 60 metres, you know that, Tony. So I went around the back of the pack, and as you just mentioned there, there was Robert Domenico standing at the back of the pack and was going to block my run. And I thought to myself, shall I run left of him? Shall I run right? And I thought, oh, frig it. I'll run straight through him. So I broke his chest plate in 9 places down his sternum. So, yeah, that was a... I got called the thug from West Australia, the bash artist and that sort of thing in the paper the next day. But Dipper tried to get me for 6 years, Tony. That's the point. 3 years at Carlton, of course, in about 3 state games. Never did. And we often talk about it that, you know...
And there wouldn't be too many players about that could claim Dipper as a scalp. You pulled up all right from the clash.
Yeah, fine, mate. The next week was a bit awesome, though. Ronnie Andrews grabbed me by the scruff of the throat. I thought, what's going on here? That was the third game. We went out to Waverley again. It was 70,000 there again, and run onto the ground, and I ran past Andrews, and he said, Bahadja told me you're a weak so-and-so. You know, that's the... Tony Bahadja, our great little rover from Western Australia State game. At about the 10-minute mark, Tony, I ran past him, he was throwing this right, and he's hit me under the chin and give me 15 stitches under the chin. I stopped and propped and I don't know how I did it. I threw one back and I hit him in the side of the face, and he just sort of looked at me and he said, "That's the only thing you could have done, but me not to keep bashing, crashing you all day." Excuse me. And umpire Robinson come over and said, "Right, you've got two in each. You want to keep going with it?" I said, "No, I've had enough. In those days, Tone, you got away with that sort of thing. But now, they would have taken the trial by video or whatever, and we may have got 3 or 4 weeks each, which I get disappointed with, Tone, and we'll get onto that local football.
Scrutiny is huge, isn't it? You kicked 8 goals against South Melbourne at Princes Park, I think in the 9th round of 81.
Yes.
You have good recollections of that particular afternoon?
Vivid memories. Terrific. It was such a great team performance. I think I kicked 8 or 9 after quarter time. I don't think I touched the ball in the first quarter. And excuse me, I kicked 3 in the second. Took a couple of overhead marks, but it was one of those days, Melbourne days, Tone, where it was drizzly and I think I was a bit better player when it was slippery and that, because I prided myself on being very skillful because of the Perth grounds. You know, the Perth grounds were very hard, and we can tone our skills, a lot better. And I think I kicked 3 or 4 in the third quarter and 3 or 4 in the last quarter. So it got me up to about 8 or 9 or whatever it was. And but again, the memories are great, but I just keep coming back. You couldn't do these things if you didn't have a great side around you.
No,
you know, I'm in that Bruce Dool room now. You can see Bruce and Roddy Ashman and Kenny Hunter, and I just keep thinking back into those. And I was very, very fortunate to play with champions and legends of the club like those.
And again, it happened at Princes Park, and we've spoken briefly about your time on the ground. Of course, today's Carlton players don't have that opportunity to play games of premiership points at Visy Park, as now known.
Yeah.
But for those that have never played there, to run out onto Princes Park, what was it actually like? You know, if you paint the picture of that place, what would you say?
Oh, an honour for a start. An honour, to play. And as I mentioned before, the old jumper, Tony, was the acrylic with the woven CFC, which, a lot of people battled for, not a lot got. And I feel a little bit sorry for the current players, or the last 10 years or whatever. They've had that polyester, which is, I know it's pressed on, but it's puffed and that sort of thing. But in those days, you really had to earn that jumper. And I think that's what a lot of the old guys, pull back. And, Tone, I've got the number 4 premiership jumper, at home in the grand final. And we wore the same jumper all year, Tone. Now they probably wear about 6 a week or something. Poor old Juddy must, use 4 or 5 a game because they get ripped off him and that sort of thing, because it's just that easy to do. But look, Tone, a real honour for me to wear that jumper, and I'm very, very proud. And, people say, you're an Eagles buzzer and Dockers. I said, you've got to be joking. I'm CFC right through,
True blue. Is it true that you told Mark McClure that you'd take him for a ride in the new car, you would win before taking Mark of the Year?
Now, that's another good story, Tone. Kenny and I had a very good rivalry. We were both, high flyers, and, Kenny took some unbelievable marks. And I was out one day, I just said I deserved a little bit of manual leave, so I had 1 week off, I was watching it from the stand, and McClure happened to be out as well. Kenny's taken this absolute screamer on the half-back line, and everyone went up, and McClure turned to me and he said, "Well, let's just fix the Mark of the Year up, Buzz. What are you going to do?" And I just tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Look, don't worry about it, Sellers. I'll fix this up next week." And you know what happened? We played Geelong the next week. Now, I was sitting in the stand, and you can ask McClure this. This is a true story. I don't know where it come from. I just tapped him on the shoulder and I said, "Sellers, I've just had a premonition." He said, "What are you talking about, Buzz?" And I said, I've just had a premonition. I've just taken a screamer in the goal square." And he said, Mark McClure was like, and would you believe it? And the cross, of course, is still out on the end of the 10-metre square there, Tone. The big Mark come along, and that's a true story. And I actually said to him on the way down, "You can have the tyres if you want, Sellers,
It's a magnificent story. And look, Buzz, we're looking at the photo here on the wall now, and we're lucky in this day of video footage that it's there for time immemorial on film. The fact you took it in front of the Heatley stand was an added bonus, but can you take us through it? I mean, does it just happen in an instant?
Oh, look, it did. Yeah. I think Wellesley was about 35, 40 metres out, Tony, and he couldn't kick over a jam tin, so I thought, there's no use leading because he won't pass. So I sort of ran back into the back of the pack, and Mark Voss, as the great Geelong backman there, And Johnny Mossett was backing back into the pack, you know. And as the ball come in, it dropped a little bit short. It may have been, you know, the wind affected it. And, you know, I sort of jumped. And as you can see in the photo, he's actually bending. But as he stood up, he took me up with it. And, you know, that's another probably 10 feet. That's on the way down, Tony, that mark, you know. So that shot. But no, just you just said it. It was a one opportunity. It sort of come off. I get a bit disappointed. There's no more great marks, you know, taken. Walks took one a couple of years ago. You know, Moorcroft took one, you know, probably 10 years ago now. You know, the real high flyer. But that's a good pack mark. You know, I just get disappointed that there's no big pack mark because they don't kick it down the ground any longer, Tone. You know, they chip it across the ground, they chip it over the thing, and that I think that makes it, you know, the more that the you know, the high flying, you know, forward is no longer, you know, maybe a part of the game.
So that frustrates you generally, yeah, speaking. The game's, yeah, played differently, mm, and perhaps there's no more or not as much room, yeah, for flair and finesse.
Yeah. Well, people said to me, "What would you do with the flood?" I said, "Oh, it would have been great. It would have been more hits for me to jump on."
Fair point. And of course, this was only the first leg of the
triple crown. That's right.
We'll get to that shortly. But obviously, you know, 81. I mean, it was just like a fairy tale year. You know, for the team and for yourself, yeah, particularly first year in Ken Hunter. We get to 81, of course, you know, again, it was the team was sitting pretty going in the final series.
Yep.
And really, you know, took all before them. Yep. 81, I mean, it wasn't without its moments. I mean, you know, the whips were cracking in the third quarter and Carlton were actually down.
Yeah. Tane, can we just go back to the start of 81? And I'll get to that in a minute. The signing is a conjecture to a lot of people. They've often asked me, and over the last couple of years, I've found out different things from different Carlton officials, you know, how they actually signed me. And you mentioned the form four, of course, with North Melbourne, and then the father son. Well, I played some terrific scratch matches or practice matches for the Blues with Kenny and Mike, you know, and Carlton bloody hopeless, Tonians, practice matches, aren't they? And they just didn't try. I rang Dad and I said, "Dad, they don't try this much." "You just wait, son, you just wait," you know. So I played some good games, and the Friday night, picked in the side. "Oh, Peter, you may not be able to play tomorrow because we haven't got your clearance yet." And I said, "Well, what's going on with that?" He said, "Oh, Wes Lopes has been, you know, saying that we don't want this kid for a couple of weeks." But in the end, they went with me because Johnson was down, and I think they wanted to bring me in from there. So, look, it's, you know, it's all history now, and you know, I grabbed the opportunity when I did. Maybe I was a replacement for Johnson for 8 or 9 or 10 rounds before he come back. But in the end, I think we got two outstanding half forwards with a outstanding centre half forward, which made it a very, very good line for the Mosquito fleet to come through. And, you know, it worked very well, very
and
well.
And to run out, yeah, for your first grand final, your first year of footy, you know, do you recall... Look, making the few steps down the race and onto the ground, what
you're
that
right.
was like?
You're right, Tone. And, you know, the second semi-final was fantastic because... you know, the smother, the second leg come in then, of course, you know, and we played Geelong out at Geelong, and we won by, you know, 7 or 8 goals in the end, and that really, you know, presented us into the grand final.
It would be remiss of me not to refer to that, Peter, and apologies for that oversight, actually, because I was there in that game, the second semi, and it happened, as it often does, right in front of me in the forward pocket.
Yes, yeah.
And I'll tell you, Peter, it's the first and last time I've seen a standing ovation given at the football for a moment of individual brilliance. But that was an extraordinary passage of play.
Well, again, Tone, it was something that Parkin had drilled into me. You know, we had to be desperate. We had to keep the ball in the forward line and et cetera, et cetera. The ball came over the back of the pack. It was a typical Jimmy Buckley pass. It went five metres over my head, so I had to chase it. And it went into the forward pocket. You know, one of the Nankervis, the Leyland brothers, picked it up. And I just dived from about, you know, 55, 60 foot away. And smothered about 5, you know. But, you know, it gets better with age, as you know, Tone. About 5 or 6 feet away, smothered the ball. Now, was that close to going out of bounds? It wasn't funny. And I picked it up and I thought, oh, I'll run in and kick an easy goal here. But they'd actually covered it. Geelong had actually covered the thing in. So I just threw a wild boot at it. And you wouldn't believe it, but it's just spun around the post. And I thought, gee, that's a good goal, you know. Stood up, the hands went in the air, Tone, you know. I thought, oh, you know, hallelujah. And The Dominator Johnson's come straight at me for 100 mile an hour and nearly knocked me out. He gave me a dip of shirt front. McLewis come over and says, get up, you weak. I mean, they've got three and a half quarters to go yet, you know. He was always a, you know, such a inspiration to us, McLewis, you know. And, but he was great because he got everyone going. But look, again, Tone, that was just a thing I thought, you know, that I had to do for the side. And it come off in a spectacular fashion. Southby usually says to me, it really inspired the team that
Absolutely.
Day. And that's what I think football's all about because, you know, a Johnson smother and dives into the pack and handballs it out. That's an inspiration too that, you know, a lot of people don't, you know, give credit for it just because I did, you know, did that. It was an important time of the game too, Tone, actually, because I think they kicked three goals in that time and we hadn't scored. You know, so about the 20-minute mark, and, you know, as I said, Southby often said to me, he said, well, that was the catalyst of getting us going, so...
And, of course, in the end, I think the team won quite comfortably
yes.
in that game.
Yeah.
Went fast forward a week, you know, or 2 weeks to the grand final, and, again, this was a tough contest.
Yeah.
Collingwood were up and
yeah.
about, and yeah. late into the third quarter, it was looking a bit grim.
Look, you've got your record there quite good because I thought to myself at the 20-minute mark of the third quarter, we were gone. The chant went up, Collingwood, you know, and I thought to myself, gee, and they were getting behind them. And, Tony, we just talked about the second semi-final smother. Wayne Harms did an unbelievable thing, and Jimmy Buckley kicked a goal virtually straight on three-quarter time and got us back from about 24 till about 12. David Parkins comes screaming down the race. I don't know whether you know this. Comes screaming down the race. They're gone. We're going to run over them. We're going, geez, what's David saying, you know? He'd actually saw them stop. You know, that's what sort of coach this man was, you know. Maybe the coaching staff actually did it as well. He stopped running. And he instilled that into us at three-quarter time. And that boosted me because I had a fairly quiet 81 grand final time. I had a good after half time because I did a lot of me, you know, 1% things, etc. for the side. And I thought I have to work harder because I was, you know, I was a bit overawed. And I'll admit it, I was a bit overawed because, you know, the 118,000 people there, probably the second best in history. And, you know, I got a bit overawed. But I tell you what, Tone, I was ready next year. I was ready in 82, you know, so... but, you know, 81, absolutely sensational. When that, you know, and it was tough, you're right, it was tough. I think we kicked 4-14 or 5-14 in the last quarter. So we had, you know, we had a lot of the ball and Collingwood couldn't get the ball.
And the Collingwood team was totally overrun. I think it was a period in play in which Carlton absolutely dominated. When Parkin strode down the race at three-quarter time and said what he said, did you actually believe him? Did you feel yourself that you had enough in the tank to get through that last 30 minutes?
I certainly did because, Tony, in those days, it was only the five. Now, we won the second. We had a break for the second semi. The second semi we played, we had a break, and then we went into the grand final. So I knew that we were very, very fresh. Collingwood had the four games during that final series. And we actually heard that Tommy actually coached them for around about an hour and a half or 2 hours on the Thursday night. So all this was put into the computer, Tony. And I think, as I said before, Parkin was such a tactician coaching and read games just beautifully. I think he honestly knew what was going on. And we were inspired at, you know, I don't think we didn't have the will and the idea that we'd lose the game. I think that was just the inspiration that we needed, that the coach had seen something and you know, the assistant coaches were onto us all during that three-quarter time huddle. And I think it was just something that was instilled to us because, you know, we just took all before us in that last quarter.
And there's a famous photograph, Peter. I think you were thereabouts when a boundary throw-up was called and the siren went. You've got all these fellows, yourself included, with your arms in the air.
Yes, yes.
Do you remember, you know, that moment of elation?
Do.
Is it relief as well?
Well, probably no, Tone, because you know you're going to win and you want it to keep going, you know. It's such a, you know, and I'll get on to 82. That was a different feeling because we really had to work. But 81, you know, we knew probably about halfway through the last quarter, I think Ashley kicked a couple and I think Jono kicked a couple. So we went from, you know, about 9 points down to about 9 points, 15 points up, you know, and we were going to win easy. We were peppering the goals as well, and they hardly got it down. I think Kenny Hunter had Dacos under control, and Brucey had Craig Davis under control. So, you know, it was just pleasurable. You know, it was pleasurable that we was waiting for that sign. Because when it does go down, you do get a bit emotional, a bit elated, of course, because you've had a win.
Was Bob there to see that?
Yes, he was at both grand finals. He's been gone about 14 years now, so he was elated, and you know, great to have him there, and you know. It was sort of a calculated, you know, a period structure, you know. He didn't want me to go, you know, until I was probably 6 or 7 years of waffle footy. And, of course, these young blokes don't get that now, you know. Like Kenny and I actually played 100 games before we come over. So we were matured and we were well-developed. And virtually, as I've mentioned many times, we fitted in to the great Carlton side, which it was.
So fast forward, Peter, 1982. Again, you know, the team was gearing up for back-to-back premierships, defending its 81 grand final victory. Looking back on the 82 year, did it went smoothly for the team and for yourself?
Don't know whether it went smooth, Tone. I think we didn't win the first two or three or four games. You know, we may have lost one, and I think we drew one, and won't play. Well, I think we had a bit of a premiership hangover, you know, and we thought things were going to happen. But I think around about round 8 to about sort of 16, we really played some great footy. Richmond were a very good side. Very good side, you know. And our nemesis was bloody Essendon. And we couldn't beat Essendon, Tone, you know. And we just didn't want to face them, you know. We've had a couple of 1 point against them, and the very, very, very famous one out here where Fitzy got the ball taken off him. We were 5 goals up, would you believe, about 4 minutes to go, and we lost it. And we just couldn't beat them. So, but they never got to us in the finals, Tone. So we played the 4 games that year. You know, I think Hawthorn beat them, so we went into the second semi-final. Now, that day, Tone, I got a week suspension for abuse, and Jono got 2 for hitting Polkinghorne of Hawthorn. So we had to get Jono through 2 games to get him into the grand final, you know. So then we played Richmond the next week, and Richmond belted us, Tony, belted us, 72, 74 points. So the Parkin mind and the park and planning went into vote. Now, I've never spoke to him about it, but I'll bet you that's what he did. We played Hawthorn the next week, Tone, and we struggled without Johnston and a couple of others. Did David Clark come in, Frank Marcazzani come in, and we struggled to beat them by about 13 or 14 points, Tone. So they give us no hope the next week. Johnston was in, and, you know, I was out, and I was very rusty against Hawthorn. But, you know, and virtually I was back for the grand final as well. So we've got 2 players coming back in. We lost Curly Austin around about 2 days before the clash. So we had to, again, fix the side up. It did, correct, Tone, yeah. And, of course, the rest is history. We went out there. And Richmond was a very tough game. It was a very tough game. But they're the great games to win, though, aren't they?
Bruce Steele, Peter, has related the story about the great fear he had on the prospect of standing Brian Taylor in the 1982 Grand Final. And he wasn't sure that Taylor was going to take his place. And he relates his story how warming up minutes before the Grand Final and seeing Taylor and his civvies over in the race, and what a relief that was to him.
Yeah.
So again, I guess the planets align. You know, there was that disappointment in the Richmond game.
Yep.
The boys rebounded and got those 2 good players back, yourself included.
What happened there, Tone, was that we changed a fair bit. A bloke called Landy used to pick me up against Richmond. Now, David kept me on the ground, off the fence until he didn't trust me because, you know, I get a little bit of white line fever. You know that, Tone, you saw a few. I got a bit of white line fever when I went on the ground, and it all hell broke. We kicked the first 3, Tone, as you remember. We kicked the first 3 in about the first 8 minutes, played some fantastic footy, flow on, you know. We got some, you know, right free kicks at the next time. That was okay, but we never scored till about the 20-minute mark of the second quarter. They kicked the next 7, Richmond. Fight. They started to fight. They blew because, you know, they thought we were a little bit weak and the mosquito fleet, etc., etc. But they didn't know we had big wow. Warren Jones, you know, he absolutely terrified 2 or 3 of them. And I do believe that, you know, some of the things wow did that day was it went to a long, long way to us winning that game. I took a terrific mark about the 20-minute mark, handballed it to Kenny, kicked a goal, and we kicked a couple more just to get back sort of, you know, on half-time. And we were outplayed, Bobby Tones, from about halfway through the first quarter to half-time. I think we kicked the first 2, and then Richmond cheated. They brought someone onto the ground, you know, that didn't have a Richmond jumper on. They had 19 players on the field. That was the streaker.
Now, I have spoken to Alex Marcoux about the streaker and where he was at the time.
Oh,
you
get a colourful remission from the Alex Marcoux, wouldn't you?
Oh, he kept it above board. But I'm wondering where you were when it happened and what you actually did. You
know, okay, I'll tell you. This is the true story, Tony. She went to Brucey Dill first, but Brucey doesn't talk to anyone, so she had to go to the next one. Now, she went to the Dominator. Now, she shouldn't have done that because the Dominator grabbed her and threw her in a 360, and she was on the way to me. She was on the way to me next, and I was going, come over here, love. And Fitzy's grabbed up on the scruff of the neck and pushed her off the ground. Of course, the police come over. But look, Tony, that could have been a dangerous part of the game.
We had a run on.
We did. That's right. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. And you know, I think just after she, you know, Fitzy got us and just said, look, you know, don't lose the sight. Don't lose the what's going on. You know, and then I think we've kicked the next three. I think I kicked one, and I handballed a couple of, to Ashy and one to Fitzy, and we kicked the five goals within about, you know, that 10 or 15 minute period. So instead of going in about 15 points down, Tone, I think we went about 8 points up at three quarter time. Now Parkham was very subdued in that time because he probably couldn't judge how they were going because they'd actually had a break, so they were fresh. So he just went in there and said, "Look, boys, you've got the chance to you know, go into history back to back." Hardly been done, you'll be remembered forever. And that was a great inspiration for us. And we just slugged it out in the last quarter. And I think we kicked four or five in that last quarter. They kicked it one or two and we won by three goals, which happened to be, Tony, the first 8 minutes of the game was three goals.
Absolutely.
And the rest of the game was a line ball.
And it was one of the great grand finals, the 82 grand final. Ken Hunter probably wouldn't remember a lot of it. I think Jim Jess twice took him out in that game.
Well, look, I keep saying it. You know, one of the greatest players I've ever played with was Ken Hunter. And I'm not ashamed of saying that. You know, I know he comes from Western Australia, but, you know, I really do put him in probably the other 20 that were with me in those 2 years, you know. And it's remiss of me to say because we had 26 or 28 players in a group that helped to win a grand final. But those 21, and we had Swan Mackay, as you remember, Tone's retired and Greg Wells retired. I think only two changes the next year. So that goes to show what a great side, you know, that particular side was.
Do you care to volunteer the best Carlton player in your time, Peter?
Oh, no doubt. Bruce Dool. Absolutely no doubt. You know, he epitomised everything, even on Sundays, Tone, you know, like we'd play the Catholic Wars, you know, and the Protestants versus the Catholics. And Brucey took it as a, you know, we'd have to, Jono and I'd have to dual team him to keep him out of the game, Tony. But it was just fun again. It was just, you know, something that Parkin had brought in and just made it, you know, good for us. But, geez, you know, Pleasant Sundays were pretty good after that too, Tone.
Absolutely. Now, Peter, time is the enemy, so yes. We move it along. But I do want to talk about the penultimate game of the 1983 home and away season against North, which was your last
bit
game
disappointing.
For Carlton.
Yeah, yeah.
You were reported and suspended 4 weeks for striking John Law.
Yeah, yeah.
And you prophetically said at the time that this might be it, and it was.
Yeah.
What was your rationale at that time?
Very disappointed because it was a reflex action, Tone. He grabbed me. I sort of swung around at him with an open hand. He said that actually in the tribunal. Goal square, Tony, running across the goal square. That's where it happened. He never went off the ground. Never. He actually said that in the evidence. The umpire came into the tribunal, Tony, and said, "Your Honour, I saw player four King hit player 13 from North Melbourne." I've just sunk back in my chair and I've gone, this bloke's got no idea. It was in the centre square, about 5 metres from the centre circle. I said, he's got the wrong incident here. Bang, 4 weeks, they give me time. Dismissed mine and Law's evidence, and they took it on the umpire. So I got 4 weeks. So I was going to miss finals, et cetera, et cetera. And also I was up for hitting Gary Dempsey. Now, it was just a feather touch, and they just dismissed it straight away. But I was just distraught. I couldn't go through the second, you know, they had to, postpone the hearing for 20 more. I composed myself, you know, and I've actually said in the thing, look, you know, I haven't done anything wrong here. Well, why have they suspended me? And the three judges were sitting just across the way, but they didn't. They didn't take anything from it. But look, I was really distraught, Tony, because I thought to myself, as you just said, that could be, you know, the end of my career with the famous club that I wanted to play with.
And of course, you're only 26 years of age at the time. I know there were other circumstances, but your father took ill. You had to return
leukemia. He had leukemia, so I had to go back and do a. But look, John Elliott came in and he threw everything at me, Tony. You know, I won't tell you the figures, but it was just astronomical. You know, in today's term, I would be on about 1.8 million, I'll tell you. And that's no word of a lie. And he wanted me there. He, you know, we want to build the side around you. We've got Coonahan, Bradley Motley coming, and the five-year plan, as we were just talking about a while ago, was in place again. You know, we still had the Fitzies and we still had the Ken Hunters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it was a great period of the club, you know, the club at the time. And I went back and played with Perth, and we couldn't make the finals that year, and I said to myself, look, you know, I would like to go back to Carlton. So, unfortunately, played a state game, and everything was in place, Tony, for me to come back. I was playing on their Queen's birthday, Footscray. That actually picked me. You know, Parkin had actually picked me. Now, all the kerfuffle went around. He doesn't want to play with Perth. He does. He doesn't. And I left it to the two clubs to organise the clearance. Apparently, Tony, and you won't believe this, it was all over 5,000. Carlton wanted 20,000 pay me for the rest of the year. Perth wanted 25. And I actually said to Ian Collins a couple of years ago, if I hadn't known that, I would have put the 5,000 in myself. Mm. Because that was my respect and my willingness and urge to get back and play, the great football. I played a couple of state games. People say I failed when I went back to Western Australia, Tony. I was picked in State of Origin games when I was playing at the Perth Footy Club in 84 and 85. So I sort of refute a bit about that I failed when I went back. Because they don't pick duds to play in State of Origin games, Tony, when those great State of Origin games. Remember, 84, Tony, I kicked four goals off on half-forward flank, and a bloke called Gary Ablett introduced him to the football world. He kicked nine off a half-forward flank for Victoria. What a game that was.
And you talk about the 5,000. I can remember Greg Williams walked out on Geelong for the sake of $5,000. And you do wonder what might have been had he stayed at Geelong.
Yeah.
Peter, you did make the effort to come back, the summer of 85,
yes,
86.
Yep.
Why didn't it work?
I actually broke. No, I didn't break. I very severely did tendons in my ankle. Would you believe this? It was the last training session under Robert Walls. We had the class of 86. There was Dora, myself, Styx, Brattles, and Peter Motley all in a terrific photo.
Inside football. Yes, I remember that photo.
Right.
I covered
training
session.
I've still got it at home, and I still look at it and think, geez, I would have loved... Tony, look, I know this is going to Carlton people, but I would have loved to play with Kernaghan, and I would have loved to play with Bradley, and I would have loved to play with this bloke here, Silvani, But that's, as you mentioned before, that's hindsight. I had the pleasure to play with Southby and Brucey Doole and, Barry Armstrong, all the greats. And, Tony, that's what I get. I lose that a little bit now. You go into the rooms now, there's not too many superstars, champions and legends around the club now, which I a little bit miss. I come over, Jezza, Big Nick, Bruce Condon, legend after legend. And Tony, they oozed aura off them. And you did. You think, oh, geez, I want to play well for this club because these guys are, here. I think these young blokes, probably need that sort of thing. So, look, Mick, I'm always here if you want me to sit in the rooms for you and people can come to me. And I'd be quite happy to, to pass on. Yeah.
Peter, it's magnificent to hear you reflect on your career. What a career it was at Carlton. All too brief, but gee whiz, it's one that people that we're privileged enough to it play out.
Thank you, Tom.
Will not forget. Mm. I always finish with one last question, Peter. What does Carlton mean to you?
Oh, look, everything. I've still got compassion. I'm the biggest West Australian supporter in there, and when the Mighty Blues play well, which is still a lot of the time, the chest puffs out, and that's my side, etc., etc. But look, football's changed, as I said before, Tony. It's more a big business. It was a $90 million game when I played, and when you covered it, it's a $900 million game now. I don't think it's any better off, but we're still evolving all the time, and the Mighty Blues are always going to be there, and they're the greatest club in the land, and we all know the CFC, and that's what I think. I hope that some of our future, well, current and future players really play for, because the CFC is worth fighting for.
Great note to end it with, Peter. An absolute pleasure to hear you talk today. The great number four in the studios. To the listeners, that's all from today's podcast. Thanks to Luke Ganano for producing the program. We look forward to speaking again shortly when we will have in our company another great of the Mighty Blues. Thank you again.